Buddy, and welcome to another beautiful rainy Thursday morning here in New York. So glad to be with you. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. My surprise guest is Chad Marvin. Chad is a master's degree candidate from working in sustainability, and he is a former IE Green intern. He is a graduate student in sustainability studies from Stony Brook, and he is a fellow Peace Corps candidate. And so Chad will be joining me in just a little bit, and I'll tell you more about Chad and what he's up to now in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you what's going on in the news, some ways you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with all of you. So starting in the news, I wanted to share with you that our new governor, Governor Kathy Hochul here in New York, has established a new climate justice fellowship program. And it's really an exciting opportunity for people living in disadvantaged communities to apply for this fellowship to train and be mentored as full-time fellows in climate justice. And we have seen through the pandemic that climate justice is so integral in and a part of social justice and environmental justice. And they are all so closely connected, and climate justice really will focus on the impact that climate change has on so many of the disadvantaged communities. And they will focus on these populations that are most heavily impacted by climate change. And they will be working with startups and already established community-based organizations. And so if you want to apply, I do have a link on my website for that. Or if you know someone that might be a good candidate for that, please spread the word. This year, I don't remember how much money they have invested in it for this year, but next year, I think it even doubles. So it's really just getting started, but it's an exciting new program. So I encourage everyone to support it. And then Slow Food North Shore, which is our local slow food chapter of Slow Food USA, which is an international organization. Slow Food USA has over 200 chapters of this international organization. And Slow Food is committed to good, clean, and fair food. And I've talked about it many times over the years. I've been the chair of our local Slow Food chapter for 10 years now. I must admit, I have not done as much as I would like to the last couple of years with COVID, or the last year and a half with COVID. But I am so committed to the organization and what they promote. And it's all about, as I said, good, clean, and fair food, meaning good for the planet, good for your body. Fair, meaning they're taking care of the farm workers as well as the farmers, and also fair to the consumers that you're going to get a good product. And clean, meaning it's not environmentally destructive. And so they just are so committed to doing good work and also equity issues. So Slow Food USA is just a wonderful organization, and Slow Food North Shore, our local chapter, will be partnering with the Cinema Arts Center and the Sisters at St. Joseph on September 18th for a free documentary screening of a film called Farming the Future, Farm Life on Long Island. And if you are in the Long Island area, I recommend you coming out. We had another one free documentary the end of August out at the Suffolk County Farm, and it was really a great event, and this one will be too. There are tours of the local farms that rent space at the Sisters of St. Joseph. And if you haven't been to the campus of the Sisters of St. Joseph, it's so impressive. They have a solar field. They have a water catch program. They have so many innovative programs going on. They rent their building to a Muslim school as well. And they rent plots to farmers. And so there's a couple different farms that are housed at the Sisters of St. Joseph, and there will be a tour of those farms. There will be some food trucks. There will be live music. So it's really going to be a fun day, and that's on September 18th. It starts at 5 o'clock with the live performances of the Sound Cellar. There will be native plants available from the Long Island Native Plant Initiative. As I said, food trucks and tabling. Slow Food will have a table, as well as the Strong Youth and other local organizations. And there's a playground. Then at 7 o'clock, we'll introduce the film, and some people from the Sisters of St. Joseph will talk about the programs they have there. And then the screening will happen, and then there will be a Q&A afterwards. I've been invited to be on that Q&A, along with some other experts in the field. So I hope to see you September 18th. Bring a picnic lunch. You can bring enough to share with your friends and family. Bring utensils. Bring tables or a bench and chairs, just so that you're comfortable, because it's going to be a nice hangout time. And dress for the weather. And so that's one of the things happening. And then for Take Action, I've written about healthy school meals constantly. And for those of you that know me, know how close to my heart that is. So many kids come home to empty refrigerators and do not have the options of eating well at home. And they really depend on school for their healthy food. And there's a new piece of legislation that the House of Representatives will be discussing, called the American Families Plan. And this new piece of legislation has can provide $1 billion to schools to create healthier meals. And that can go a long way in helping to make the meals healthier. Because even though they've been trying for years, it's really hard with the small budget that these schools are given. You know, the small budget of maybe $2 a person, maybe not even $1.50, has to not only pay for the food, but also the staff, the insurance, all of it's together. And so supporting healthy school meals for our kids is so important. We also know that if you're hungry, you can't learn as well. It's really important that you come to school and that you're satiated. Otherwise, you're going to be focusing on your growling stomach and not able to really think. So it's really important. School meals during COVID have been free, and we're also looking to continue that program so that the meals can continue to be free for everyone, because there's always been stigma attached to those kids that have to show a special pass to get their free meal. And so many kids will choose to go hungry rather than that stigma of showing that they need help. So by giving free food to all the kids, it removes that stigma and makes everybody on a level playing field. And it's really been a wonderful thing during COVID, and we're hoping that that can continue. Also, I wrote about lawsuits that are happening now. Activists are going to the courts. For years, we've been trying to hold food corporations accountable for the labeling they put on their food packaging, and it has not worked. Our government does not regulate these labels. If something says sustainable or humanely raised or all natural or healthy, it really means nothing. It sounds good, the pictures look good, but what are they really doing? And, you know, it's come out that, you know, a company like Cargill, who produces most of the turkeys, they say that their farmers on the label are independent family farmers. Well, that couldn't be further from the truth. These farmers are all contract farmers. If any of you saw the film Food Inc. or What the Health, you know how these farmers get into contracts with these big food producers, and they have them wrapped around their finger. They can demand that they buy special equipment. They can demand that they have a certain minimum number of poultry animals there. And these animals, even though they say they have access to outdoors, they are too squished and fat to actually get outdoors. So they don't go outdoors. And so these claims are really bogus. And finally, these activists are taking to the court and really making some headway there. Sargento Cheese says that their cheese contains no antibiotics. However, when they went to the lab and tested them, they did have trace elements of antibiotics. Tyson, we've all heard about Tyson during COVID. Their claims for, all natural chicken couldn't be further from the truth. All their all natural chicken, after they don't maybe give the chickens antibiotics, they then soak all of the chicken in a chemical bath to kill any, to disinfect them from any pathogens. So we really need to not allow these claims to happen. And what this also does, all these claims, puts the real small family farmer who really is doing it right at a huge disadvantage, because they can't compete financially with the cheap prices that these big corporations offer. And so a small family farmer who's really raising organic chickens, that whose chickens really have access to the outdoors, who are really feeding them organic food, all their costs are so much more. And we also don't hold these food manufacturers accountable for the contamination that they cause to the environment and force them to deal with the cleanup. Instead, that goes to the taxpayer. And if they had to pay for the cleanups, then their product would become even more expensive than the organic farmer. And then it would be a more level playing field. But the way it is right now, it is certainly not fair. There's, loopholes in, the organic regulations. I mean, a big manufacturer of food can purchase a non-organic cow and instantly just bring it into their flock and start calling it organic, which should not be allowed. I mean, an organic cow needs to be birthed from an organic mother. And when they're not, they just are not organic. So there's lots of loopholes that these food manufacturers have been able to figure out. And we need to put stronger regulations in, and until that happens, the courts is one way where we're actually making some headway. So that's really a good thing. And now I want to share with you this week's recipe. This week's recipe is a green gazpacho soup, and it's extra green because I also put avocado in it. But I have quite a few gazpacho recipes on my website, and I've linked to them on this week's recipe as well. But the green gazpacho that I'm going to share with you has a little bit of a Mexican flair, because it has a little bit of cumin in it as well. And of course, a small jalapeno pepper. So it has a little bit of a bite and some cilantro. So this is what you need for the green gazpacho soup. And the other thing I love about gazpacho is it just is such a representation of what you have coming out of the garden or at the farmer's market. So many different things can go into your gazpacho soup. And like I said, I have so many different versions, so check them out. One of them has watermelon, and I highlight it with mint for flavor. Another one has fire roasted tomatoes. So there's, quite a variety. So check them out. So for this one, green gazpacho soup, you're going to start with 4 cups of chopped green heirloom tomatoes. You can use all sizes. If you even have some, this is a great way to use up those tomatoes that have fallen off the vine that are not fully ripened. So 4 cups of chopped green heirloom tomatoes, 2 cucumbers peeled, seeded, and diced, 2 limes that you're going to juice, 3 garlic cloves, 1/2 cup of fresh cilantro leaves, 1 small jalapeno pepper, 2 green peppers, 2 ripe avocados, green onions sliced, including the tops. And you can just do 2 or 3, whatever you'd like. Half a teaspoon of ground cumin, 3 tablespoons of olive oil, 3 tablespoons red wine vinegar, 1 cup of water, 1/4 cup of chopped parsley, salt and pepper to taste. And you can start with 1/2 teaspoon of salt and then add more if you want. And then just have a little bit of save a little bit of the cilantro for garnish on the top. And you're going to pulse the first seven ingredients in a food processor. That's the tomatoes, the cucumbers, the lime juice, the garlic, the cilantro, jalapeno peppers, and the green pepper. Pulse that. Then you're going to add the vinegar, the cumin, the olive oil, the parsley, the salt, and the avocados. Blend all that up, and then that's it. Garnish it with cilantro, and I also like to sprinkle some crumbs of tortilla chips on top. And that is it. It comes together so fast. It's so delicious, and I really recommend you making it. You know, do it now while the weather's still warm enough before the summer is really over. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest. Chad Marvin is a current master's candidate in sustainable international development at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management. He served with the Peace Corps as an agroforestry volunteer for 2 years and then extended it for another year as a cultural environmental volunteer leader. He was living in a rural community in the mountainous region of the country called Fauta Dadian. And Chad's current research is around the intersection of climate change with women and youth in Guinea. His research is informed by his role as a program associate for Aqua Farms Africa, a social impact enterprise that trains women and youth in the capital city of Ghana. And that capital is called Conakry. And there they run their own aquaponic farms. Originally, Chad's from Long Island. He interned with me many years ago while attaining his bachelor's in environmental humanities from Stony Brook University. Chad's passion is finding the links between social and environmental issues and creating long-lasting solutions that acknowledge the root causes of these problems in order to create a more equitable and sustainable world. Chad, are you with me?
Hi, Bhavani. I'm here. Can you hear me well?
Oh, very well. Thank you.
Great.
So before we really get started, I wanted you to just share some of your own personal history. Tell us about how you got interested in food and agriculture. I know that's not really in your background coming from Long Island. And
right.
What was your passion with sustainability?
Right. Great question. I think it really connects to a lot of the issues you were just flagging with industrial and kind of commercialized chemical agriculture. When I was a kid growing up on Long Island, you know, I was in a typical busy suburban family, and my parents would work morning until night and leave, you know, $5 or $10 on the counter. And I would take that money and stretch it. I'd get either pizza or Chinese food, or I'd go get a lot of fast food. And so growing up, I was really unhealthy, actually. By the time I was 14, 15, I was being tested for all these serious terminal diseases because I was having these intense stomach pains, you know, due to this intense, very poor diet that I had, although I didn't realize that was why at the time. And so at, you know, 15, 16, I really started to think, and I decided to become a vegetarian and stop eating meat. And that really opened my eyes to a lot in sustainability and food processes and, you know, how we interact with our environment and how that relates to human health.
Uh-huh. And when did you graduate from Stony Brook?
I graduated from Stony Brook University in 2017. And so there I, you know, really got to immerse myself more into the world of sustainability. Like you had mentioned, I was at the School of Sustainability Studies, studying environmental humanities. And that was really a wonderful opportunity for me because the program itself actually only started in 2013, the year I had enrolled. It shows you just how new sustainability studies is, that, you know, this is something that someone can centralize their studies in now. And you know, I feel so fortunate to have been one of the first students at Stony Brook to have been able to get a degree like that.
Mm-hmm. And when I met you at Stony Brook way back when, you actually were working at a container farm there. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I had just done a study abroad I went to Costa Rica and I had been learning permaculture, which is kind of a beyond organic form of agriculture where you try to replicate the ecology and systematic functioning of a forest in your gardens and farms, right? So everything kind of functions without you even having to do anything, right? We don't need to water a forest for it to grow. But so I was so inspired by that study abroad, and I came back and I saw that Stony Brook was looking for farmers or growers, and that they had this new container farm, a very different system. It was called a freight farm, actually. Freight farm is the business, and I think they had been contracted by Stony Brook's dining halls to help them provide a local fresh source of food. And so what it was an upcycled shipping container that had been outfitted with, you know, a pump, a motor, and a tank full of water, and a vertical farming system so that water could be circulated through this farm. And in about, you know, 4 to 6 weeks time, they had called the farm, a nickname for it was a leafy green machine, because in 4 to 6 weeks time, you could plant about or harvest about 4,000 to 6,000 heads of lettuce or herbs like cilantro or marjoram or whatever else you want to grow. And so what we were able to do was cut down on a lot of the food miles at my university. You know, Stony Brook University has thousands of students and they import tons of foods, just like every town does, just like every university and large central human dwelling does. We have to import so much food, but there we were able to grow thousands of heads of lettuce for the salad bars, all of the herbs that would garnish and be used to season a lot of the dishes that were cooked there. And it was really unique. We actually had the first freight farm of any university in the U.S. At Stony Brook at the time.
Wow. And so I got it right. You said 4,000 to 6,000 heads of lettuce every 4 to 6 weeks.
That's right. Wow. Can you time
them so that you didn't have them all coming at once? You'd like every week you had a bunch of, you know, 1,000 coming up so that you.
Yeah. You can kind of stagger your planting schedule, and you can also, because it's a closed unit, right? There's a temperature and humidity control, so you can adapt it for whatever you want to grow. Maybe something that's not even of that climate, but we would stagger the harvests often so that we could have, right? There's the maximum of like 6,000 that you could get at once, but then it's processing and eating all of that. But often we would stagger it so you could have 1,000 or a few hundred heads of lettuce or herbs each week, and provide a consistent source of food. And, you know, all of this in the back of the dining hall parking lot in a shipping container. It takes up a lot less space. And because, as I mentioned, the water is in a tank and it's just being circulated by a pump, it used 90% less water than traditional agriculture, this hydroponic farm, because all of the water that the plants didn't take, you know, just filtered back through the pipes and went back into the tank and just kept circulating around until the plants needed it or, you know, would otherwise just return. But no water escaped the system. So you avoid that, the losses of water that agriculture has.
Right. And there's lots of, you know, controversy and discussions about aquaponics versus organic and or hydroponic, I should say, because it doesn't have the soil. But I don't really want to get into that today because I really believe there's room for all of these growing methods. The only one that there's not room for is the traditional one that's, you know, chemically founded. But anyway, I just didn't want to get off course because we have so much to talk about. I want to talk about your time in the Peace Corps. First, did you know when you were in as an undergraduate, did you know you wanted to go to the Peace Corps? Was that something you just decided, you know, your senior year? You know, how long a process is it to apply, and how did you choose what country you wanted to go to?
Yeah, thank you for asking. So I think by my sophomore year, I was really thinking about applying to the Peace Corps. I was considering it. I think growing up in Long Island, you know, a very suburban, humanized place. We have some nature and preserves you can go to, but it is one of the, you know, biggest suburban sprawls of any city. This is the tax base for New York City, really. And studying sustainability studies in my university and realizing how interconnected the world is, how, you know, pollution and what we eat, how we consume our food, just all relate to the entire global population. I really wanted to work at the global level. And so by my sophomore year of university, I was considering that. And so early during my senior year, you had asked how long the application process is. I started pretty much at the beginning of my senior year because, you know, you go through rounds of interviews. You have to fill out a quite long application with all of your experiences, go through rounds of interviews, you know, prove that you're healthy, prove that you have the right mindset kind of culturally to live in another place and get along well with people and not create problems or, you know, that you're going to end up having some sort of ulterior motive for going. And so I started in the fall and I got accepted pretty much a little before I was ready to graduate, maybe in April or May. And so, you know, that was a really happy time for me. I was so excited to get there and apply. And what had happened was you choose your top three choices. And then Peace Corps kind of looks at who you are, your whole application, all the rounds of interviews that you've went through. And they kind of look at what's a fit for you. So, for example, I'm vegetarian, as I had mentioned, or actually, by that time, as a university graduate, I was vegan. And I had applied to live in South America, doing conservation in Guyana with indigenous groups in a part of the Amazon. But they knew that that was a large hunting society, you eat a lot of meat. I probably would not have done that well. And Guinea was my second choice. I was in Guinea-Conakry in West Africa. And Guinea, you know, and West Africa in general, they have a lot of grains and beans. They grow a lot of peanuts. There are a lot of plant-based sources of protein. And so they thought that that would be a better fit for me. And that was why I ended up heading to West Africa.
Uh-huh. And what was your area of expertise?
Right. So I was in the environment sector, but my specific role was I was an agroforestry volunteer, right? So it's bridging together agriculture and forestry and trying to create these more holistic food systems that really integrate forestry and, you know, tree planting operations, as well as things like raising livestock with your agriculture and having one holistic system for all of your, you know, food growing and homesteading sort of lifestyles and professions.
Mm-hmm. So before going there, I know this from our discussions, you know, you went through a whole training. You had to learn French and you had to learn the local cultural language, correct? Pular, right?
Yeah, Pular. Yeah, that's right. So the process is that a Peace Corps service is 27 months. The first 3 months, you're in the capital, you've arrived in the country, but you're doing pre-service training where you're getting technical sessions on, you know, maybe I had a background in agriculture and forestry, but I didn't know how that's being practiced in Guinea. So I learned about all of the norms in that field. But at the same time, as you mentioned, I was getting training in French because Guinea was a French colony during colonial rule. But then Guinea was also the first French colony to leave colonial rule and declare their independence. So people there, you know, are quite proud to speak their local languages, and each ethnic group has their own culture and, you know, set of traditions, and they want to speak their language. So I was living with the Fulani ethnic group. And so by my last month of pre-service training, I had switched over from French. And I know everyone might be thinking that's not a lot of time, 2 months of learning French and I had no background in the language before. And then you switch to another language, Pular, that's being taught to you in French. So, you know, really a steep learning curve at first, but it's an immersive thing, and you're learning in the country with, you know, university graduates from Guinea who speak English and French well, that kind of accompany you in the language learning process, bring you to local cafes, bring you to centers where you can communicate with people, take you to markets where you can practice buying food, right? So it's not so classroom based, although there is a classroom component. A lot of it was very much immersing in the world there and learning the language that way.
And then when you got to the town, I also know from our discussions, when you got to the town, one would expect that there would be another volunteer there and that you would seamlessly, you know, overlap a little bit so you could find out what they were doing and then you could continue their work. But in our conversations, I found out that wasn't really the case. You kind of went there and were on your own. How did you get started? How do you choose what projects to do if there's not someone there that has already set things up and you're just going? You have to start from scratch. How does that work?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, Peace Corps was founded in the 1960s, and some volunteers had volunteers in the communities that they went to serve in since the 1960s. For myself, however, what had happened was a volunteer in a community maybe 20 kilometers away heard about the community that I ended up serving in and that they were a very productive agricultural area and went to visit. And they had requested a volunteer then and said, please send someone. But so they had never had a volunteer before, really even the amount of outsiders that had visited this rural community that I lived in, you know, about 300 miles from the capital and only airport and very far from the nearest main road. So the process of figuring out not only what people were saying that they wanted to work on, but then also really, you know, willing to commit to, took a long time just to come to a mutual understanding and figure out the skills I have, the things that I was able to offer as kind of an agricultural extensionist. And then what actually really lined up well with the community's interests and needs. So, you know, I mean, especially speaking in two new languages for me and just integrating into a new place, it took some time to figure that out, to say the least.
And does the Peace Corps give you a budget so that if you want to go in and start a project, you have some capital to work with, or are you kind of just working with the natural resources that are there and figuring it out?
You do get a community appointed counterpart to work with you, right? So someone from that community who is a respected member of the community that is going to accompany you on a lot of the educational work that you'll be doing and even maybe help you translate or just help introduce you to people. If your language skills are strong, still just making those introductions. But then you do get a living allowance for your personal day-to-day, you know, needs. But that is really based on the salary of what the role that you're serving in is, right? So for me, I was working as an agroforestry volunteer with rural farmers. I was given money for transport and travel and food based on, you know, what the average earnings would have been for the Guinean farmers that I was working with. But with regards to projects, if you wanted to apply for a grant, you could, but it was really encouraged not to just show up as a Westerner and say, I'm here with this money to do something, right? You can really instill a lot of change just by teaching new techniques, right? So I would often go to farms and do soil tests and see the composition of the soil, what they were growing there, and if that plant was best suited for the soil, or do landscape analyses and look at land people had and what might be able to grow well where they were, and show new techniques, maybe introduce new seeds that were available in the city, but that this rural community didn't have the habit of planting, and try to make smaller changes like that would be you know, quite adaptable for these people, even after an American or Westerner leaves, because, you know, you can show up and, you know, pay all this money one time to do a bunch of things, but it's kind of that old adage, right? Like teach someone to fish or buy them a fish and the difference between that.
Right. Absolutely. So what projects did you do and what were you able to bring to that community?
Yeah. So, I did a lot of fruit tree nurseries. I actually ended up planting about 6,500 trees in total, with about 20 different groups of people. You know, some people really had big tree nurseries that accounted for a few thousand of those trees that I planted, and they were very industrious and wanted to sell the baby saplings to people in cities and do it that way. And others just wanted, you know, a few hundred trees or even 20 or 5 trees to put next to their house. But the point of planting these fruit trees was that the community I was living in really was focused on the production of nightshade vegetables. So introducing a second crop. So if it was a bad year for nightshade vegetables, now they had guava trees. Now there were cashew trees, orange, lime, lemon, jackfruit, sapsap, tons of tropical fruits that maybe people might not be familiar with here. And then aside from that, I also worked with beekeepers, introducing new types of hives, right? Kind of hives that you can use continually because there were a lot of beekeepers there making hives through a process of coating baskets with mud and cow poop and thatch and baiting bees that way. But when you harvest that hive, you know, you have to destroy it and open it up and the bees flee. So instead, you know, we were introducing what's called a Kenyan top bar hive. It's a, you know, a hive that you can make at a carpenter with whatever wood you have. And, you know, it's like the hives you see in the US here, the Langstroth hives that you can open up and continually sustainably harvest from. And so the beekeepers were able to get more harvests out of them. And that led to a lot of new innovations and excitement. We also built beekeeping suits. We brought, you know, strong, thick fabrics to local tailors and showed the tailors how to make beekeeping suits. And that was very innovative for the tailors in our community because all of a sudden, you know, they were maybe making outfits for nice occasions once in a while for people, but they had a whole new client in the beekeepers to make these bee suits for. So those were two of my main things. And I did a fun tangent, also work with the beekeepers, beekeeping an endangered species of bee. It's a stingless bee native to West Africa that does not sting, so you don't have to wear a bee suit. I much preferred beekeeping with the stingless bees to the ones who could sting you, I'll tell you that. And I actually got to connect with a stingless bee research center in another country in West Africa and translate documents that they were writing in English into French and Pular to give the community I was living in resources to understand how to work with these bees as opposed to regular bees, you know, a little bit more efficiently. And aside mm-hmm. from that, I offered French revisions at the primary school where I was living, mainly for young girls because education's a little less accessible for young girls than boys. But a lot of boys would come too, but I'd, you know, try to make a point to let the boys know that they had to let the girls speak first, right? In the classroom, usually boys are encouraged from a young age there to be quite outspoken and proud. And girls maybe get pushed to the side and don't get to raise their hand when they know the answer. So I did some French revisions with the youth, and that was the majority of my work.
Mm-hmm. Sounds great. What an experience. Now, was the village already, their methods of farming, were they organic and sustainable, or were they importing genetically modified seeds from other areas? You know, like how contained was it? You know, how protected were they from the industrial agricultural system of the world, or were they a part of it?
So things rapidly changed there, and this was a shocking thing to me to arrive so far from the main road of, far away from the nearest city, hundreds of miles away from the airport where I flew in. I thought it might be relatively untouched with regards to this industrial agriculture, but what I learned is that things changed pretty quickly. For a long time, people really were, just planting rice by hand and growing extensive gardens upkept by manpower. But the community I lived in actually happened to be right next to the Senegal River. And so it had a huge source of water, or a branch of the Senegal River that they could use for irrigation. It's fresh water. And so they had tractors, they had a lot of agricultural machinery, and they were one of the biggest exporters and just commercial productors in the country of Guinea and even West Africa as a region, all the countries that are in that region. And so they did use synthetic or artificial fertilizers. And also, I did notice that some of the bigger agricultural unions there were importing seeds from a certain French agribusiness, which really surprised me. And when I read into that agribusiness, I had a lot more questions about it because I had realized that their seeds were overly concentrated with. Or their seed stock was overly concentrated with pesticide, right? So that pests wouldn't eat the seed stock, but to the point where their workers in Europe, who were hauling these things in trucks and delivering them to farmers there and in close contact with the seed stock, received cancer or got cancer from being in close contact with these overly concentrated, potato seed stock. Sacks all the time and hauling that around. And so they had been banned from selling in Europe. And I suppose afterwards they thought, well, we have all this produce and this huge amount of stock, and we want to do something with it. And so they started selling to a lot of developing countries, one of them being Guinea, and one of those buyers being the commercial agricultural village that I lived with. So it was shocking to see that. You think some of these parts of the world are very untouched by modernity or just development and artificial stuff, but really, one way or the other, this entire world is connected, and especially when it comes down to big corporations trying to make a profit and sell what they can. And on the other side, the farmers I lived with being, quite poor, a lot of them living on less than $1.90 a day, which is the international marker of poverty, and wanting to work faster, right? If these seeds were concentrated with pesticides and were gonna take away a lot of the man hours that they put in every day, and these are still communities, that are carrying water on their heads for all of their drinking water and wash water, then they're gonna save time that way and try to get ahead a little bit. They're not able to think about the long-term environmental degradation that it might be created when they have such immediate needs.
Yeah, it's so sad how, the big corporations, when, laws become more stringent here to protect the worker and our communities, they go and they ship it off to poorer countries and contaminate them there. It's just horrible. Sounds very familiar. But anyway, I want to move on so that we can talk about what you've been doing now. I know this summer you had a great internship with Aqua Farms Africa, and they have offered you a position going forward. So can you tell us about that? I know you were set to go back to Guinea, and there's now a coup there just a couple of days ago. So your plans are kind of up in the air.
Plans are
But
up in
tell
the
us
air a
about the
little
work
bit.
you did this summer,
Sure.
the master's program you're in, the work you did this summer, and what you're supposed to be doing going into the fall.
So let me start with the master's program and just my transition. So as you mentioned, I had extended my service to stay and work in Guinea after my 27 months as an agroforestry volunteer. I was going to do a whole another year that I only got about 48 days into before COVID happened and all Peace Corps volunteers globally got evacuated in late March 2020. And so that was a real challenge for me. And I had been thinking about so many of these new global processes, or at least they were new to me. And so I decided I wanted to enroll in a graduate program where I could learn more about international development and humanitarian work. And so I found the Heller School for Social Policy and Management that had extended their application deadline, luckily for evacuated Peace Corps volunteers. And I applied there for a master's in sustainable international development. And I completed my coursework this past year remotely. You know, everything was online this past year. And then this summer, as you mentioned, I got a boost from the typical internship world that university students are in. And since I'm a graduate student, I was able to get hired as a consultant for a health organization in Guinea. I was actually just helping them build a lot of their organizational structure and provide healthcare services to people in Guinea. And since I speak the local languages, I would call and do participatory community analyses to see how effective the services were and what could be better for the local populations. But along the way, I was networking. I wanted to get back to the environment field in Guinea. And I found a former Peace Corps volunteer like myself, although her service was about a decade ago, that's been working in Guinea and has this new organization called Aqua Farms Africa that employs women and youth, which make up the largest unemployed percentage of Guineans, to run their own aquaponic farms, right? So it's like hydroponics that I talked about earlier, except you raise fish in a basin and the fish waste is what gets filtered with the water instead of just inputting nutrients and minerals artificially for the plants to have what they need mixed in with the water in a hydroponic system. In this system, the fish waste is actually a very rich fertilizer, and it gets mixed into these tanks of circulating water that feed plants. And so it creates this very lucrative and productive system for these disadvantaged groups of Guineans, mainly women, but also some youth. And I am going to be working as a program associate, just kind of helping to optimize the system. You know, I speak the local languages, so I can really collaborate well with the Guineans that they're employing, but also I can employ on my end a lot of what I'm learning in my graduate coursework. And this position counts as the field work for my master's degree, and I'll graduate in the spring and get my degree. I'll be just helping to optimize a lot of things with their organization and, you know, write some demands for funds and help update their donors that fund the work that they're doing on how things are going, write some progress reports like that.
And is this in the capital of Guinea, or is this in another remote village?
No, yeah. So as you had mentioned, I was living in a mountainous region called Fouta Djallon. But this is right in the capital city, right when you arrive at the airport. And so what's innovative about it is that Guinea really doesn't have consistent electricity, but there is something that's been created and fostered by a lot of big international humanitarian funders called Blue Zones, where they're creating these blue zones in developing countries where there will be constant electricity that they'll have set up through generators and backup generators and solar panels for innovative social impact organizations, people that are, you know, really working with disadvantaged social groups or fighting or trying to counteract climate change, which aquaponic farming also does because it's very, it's a very low water intensive system. It doesn't use a lot of water. So they give spaces in this area with constant power to power the pumps, and in our case, or whatever might be an innovative solution to a lot of humanitarian crises. And Aqua Farms Africa got one of these spaces within the Blue Zone in the capital city of Conakry to be doing this work with women and youth.
It's a little confusing because it's also areas called blue zones where people
Yes, you're
live
right.
to over 100, you know.
Where
So
there
when
are
I think your blue
centenarians.
zone, I'm thinking of those areas, those pockets where people live to over 100.
Right.
But this is a different blue zone.
Yeah, this is the humanitarian lingo, and that's the hell. I've read about those blue zones as well. They're fascinating to see the areas of the world where there are the most people living over 100 and why. So maybe I'll talk to them when I get there about changing the name, because now we have two blue zones.
It could get confusing for some people. But
Yeah.
anyway, with these farms, is it a cooperative? I know when we were talking, I think you were saying that they actually give franchises to individual women, and they get to start it almost as their own business. Can you explain how that aqua farms works?
So they have tons of space, almost like an enormous warehouse. And within that, each individual farmer or group of farmers, it can depend. An individual may come and the organization may find them to be a really high need person that is living on their own, can't find work. It can be very hard for women to find formal employment in Guinea. Or sometimes it'll be a union of youth maybe who were returned from trying to cross the Mediterranean and immigrate to Europe illegally, that have been sent back to Guinea and are now trying to do something together as a group of young people. So those might be some of the youth we get, and the cases where it's a cooperative. But so the warehouse is sectioned off into 40 foot by 40 foot sections, which is a lot of space, but each one will have a small or each one will have a small gardening section, and then a section of piping that filters in the fish waste from the really large fish basin that's there where they raise tilapia in one central tank that feeds into all of these gridded off individual farms that are available for individual farmers or unions of or cooperatives of youth or women that are choosing to work together and start their own franchise. And so then what happens is, in the capital city of Guinea and in West Africa and Africa in general, in big cities where there's a lot of where there are a lot of Westerners living, the hygiene standards may be a little more rigid, and often restaurants and hotels will be importing all of their food, putting all of these food miles on the food that gets to the plate of the people eating there. And it's silly because A, the food's coming from so far away, but B, you have a chance to be paying directly farmers or people within these poor countries and giving them economic growth by buying a lot of the produce that they buy, but they can't take the risk of it not being kind of regulated by something that would be like their version of the FDA, which doesn't exist there. So they import everything, but Aquafarms Africa is in a closed container that controls the humidity, the temperature, optimizes the conditions for the plants. And so with that, they can cut into this very lucrative market of hotels and restaurants in the capital city that are currently importing all their food, and sell them a lot of microgreens or strawberries or purple cabbage is another popular thing that the hotels request to garnish their salads with. And they are able to get these amazingly high price points and not only be, impoverished, disadvantaged people that are kind of helped and given a small package to have a slightly better life, but really have this new, super impactful job that is climate resilient agriculture in an urban setting that is connecting them to the highest possible price points and the best, upper percentage of possible employment opportunities in Guinea.
So, it sounds great, but the reality of business, if you've ever run a business, is also a huge learning curve. And so, is there in within the setup of Aqua Farms Africa set to mentor these young women in how to do that business? Because you know, if you've never run a business before, how do you make contact with restaurants? Do they have do they have internet access? Do they do it online? Do they have to go by foot to each of these restaurants? You know, how are these young people taught how to run the business so that they are successful?
Right. So Aquafarms Africa was founded by that former volunteer who I had mentioned that runs a community economic development Kickstarter business in Guinea called Dare to Innovate. And so Dare to Innovate partners with Aquafarms Africa, and they have all of these community economic development experts that do accompany each individual farmer. And not only will they help them to optimize their harvests, make sure that they're experts in the growing and production of the food and fish, but also they will help them connect to clients, have everything digitized on an app and a smartphone and tablet. And often really it's the Western administration and the people who have created this organization, Aquafarms Africa, that go directly to the hotels and restaurants and set up contracts for all of their aqua farmers, as they like to call them, in advance, so that each aqua farmer just has a set you know, amount of buyers for X produce to sell each month, and it's not like anything is in limbo or they might take an unexpected loss.
Yeah, because I would think that would have to be an integral part of this. Otherwise,
yeah, if you want to help
people, are going to fail.
People, right. Yeah, of course, you can't leave them to dry. And another big part of it is that the whole organization is run by those in the African diaspora. So my boss is West African American herself, and the other founder, likewise, is from Ghana and also has roots in the U.S. and their entire staff, the people who are administrators and run the organization, right? I'm just a small hand helping the individual farmers and writing some reports for them. But those profiting from this enterprise, and I think this is really important, are of the African diaspora themselves, or are the West African beneficiaries, the aqua farmers that they're training and employing.
Great. Now, are they also selling the fish, or is the fish just a byproduct in order to create the fertilizer, or is the fish also?
It's a secondary product. The microgreens and the produce that they're able to grow are really what garners the high price points. And Guinea is on the Atlantic coast, so there's a good amount of fish, and there's also major riverways in Guinea that people fish from. But the tilapia that they harvest, or that they use to generate all of this wonderful fish fertilizer, do get harvested when they're at full size and no longer going to be productive to be sold to the market. So it does become a second crop for the aqua farmers to sell. And that also has its own channels that are kind of, you know, pre-organized, so that they have people looking to buy tilapia when Aquafarms Africa has fish at harvest.
Sure. Well, I can't believe it. We're just about out of time. So I want to give you enough time to maybe share your contact information. I don't know if you're open to, if any of my listeners have questions about the work you're doing in Africa or the Peace Corps or anything, are you open to them reaching out to you?
Yeah, so I'll go ahead.
So share your info then, and I'll share it on my website too.
Great, great. I'll go ahead and give my personal email, because my work email is flooded with aqua farmers that I'm collaborating with that want help, and I don't want to mix up my inboxes, but my personal email is chad.e.marvin@gmail.com. And if anyone has questions or is curious to learn more about anything we've talked about today, I'm really happy to share. And Bhavani, I'm so grateful to have gotten to talk to you and to have earlier in my life interned with you and I Eat Green. It's really something that set me on my path towards, you know, doing the Peace Corps and the work I'm doing now. So thank you so much.
Wonderful. Well, Chad, thank you so much for stepping in. You were a great surprise guest for all my listeners. And everyone out there, thank you so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Bhavani and IE Queen on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'll see you all again next week.